A Warhammer Novel. Blood Money by C. L. Werner. This is a dark age, a bloody age, an age of demons and of sorcery. It is an age of battle and death, and of the world's ending. Amid all the fire, flame, and fury, it is a time, too, of mighty heroes, of bold deeds, and of great courage. At the heart of the old world sprawls the Empire, the largest and most powerful of the human realms. Known for its engineers, sorcerers, traders and soldiers, it is a land of great mountains, mighty rivers, dark forests, and vast cities. And from his throne in Altdorf reigns the Emperor Karl Franz, sacred descendant of the founder of these lands, Sigmar, and wielder of his magical Warhammer. But these are far from civilized times. Across the length and breadth of the old world, from the knightly palaces of Bretonnia to ice-bound Kislev in the far north, come the rumblings of war. In the towering World's Edge mountains, the Orc tribes are gathering for another assault. Bandits and renegades harry the wild southern lands of the border princes. There are rumors of Ratfings, the Skaven, emerging from the sewers and swamps across the land. And from the northern wilderness, there is the ever-present threat of chaos, of demons and beastmen corrupted by the foul powers of the dark gods. As the time of battle draws near, the Empire needs heroes like never before. Prologue. For me, it all began one hot summer night in the sweltering back streets of the Tylian city of Miragliano. I was in my second year of exile from my place of birth, Grand Altdorf, that emperor of all cities, that symbol of human endeavor, might, learning, and faith. It followed, as some might recall, the publication of my own retelling of history's most fearsome villain, the true history of the life of Count Vlad von Karstein of Sylvania the Vampire, that my troubles began. True, the name of Erhard Stoiker became known far and wide across the Empire. There was even an invitation to visit the Tsarina in Kislev, a land fascinated by tales of the aristocracy of the night. But in my own land, even as fame and fortune crept towards me, implacable foes arose between me and the rewards of my labors. My work was denounced by no less a personage than the Grand Theogonist himself, and the High Priest of Ulrich and Middenheim even called the novel contemptible. Literary critics, ever bowing their craven heads to the mood of the pulpit, decried my work as doggerel and claptrap, the work of a barely literate hack who doubtless thinks Sylvania is a province in Bretonnia. I could contend with such spiteful and petty detractors, for my publishers happily informed me that with every harsh word the Grand Theogonist deigned to hurl upon my volume, another 500 copies were sold. And it is in the matter of coin, perhaps, that public opinion has always been, and shall ever be, expressed. No, it was not the vitriol of the critics, nor the scorn of the pulpit that drove me to distant lands to lose myself from the Empire. It was one late night, in a darkened street, when I discovered that there were others who had taken offense at my work, and that not all my detractors were human. It was then that I distanced myself from the land of my birth. So it was that I, Erhard Stoiker, came to be sitting in the barrow-like interior of a filthy tavern in the seediest district in Miragliano, that notorious port of merchant princes, swashbuckling privateers, and dastardly smugglers. I had found my status much reduced. I, who had once put to pen some of the most well-known and sinister tales of horror to ever grace the libraries of the Empire. The last of my money, from A True History of Vlad, were fast failing, and I had been impressed upon by a most unscrupulous Tylian by the name of Ernesto, a publisher of thin tomes, foisted upon seafarers to lessen the tedium of their ocean voyages, to turn my talents to furnishing him with fodder for his shilling dreadfuls. I found my days spent lurking in the taverns of Miragliano, dutifully committing to memory the tales of seamen and mercenaries as they sank into their cups, wading through their crude dialects and inveterate boasting to seize any germ of truth behind the stories they told. It was not unlike being put to the question by an Italian torturer, those long hours of trying to endure some simpleton's vanity as he explained how he was the mightiest hero since Sigmar, or at least Conrad. Still, Ernesto needed as much material as I could furnish, and the pittance he paid for each page ensured that I furnished him with as many manuscripts as I could compose. I was deep in my cups one evening, sitting in a dockside dive known as the Maid of Albion. I was not, however, as deep as my companion, a petty banditti named Farini, who was drunkenly slobbering out his life story. He explained to me how he had become a veritable bandit prince after being villainously spirited away from the household of a noble family in Tobarro by agents of his younger brother, who had desired the title for himself. I was finding myself unable to decide if even Ernesto would be able to swallow the lout's lies, when the door of the tavern opened and my companion suddenly became sober as a priest of Mor. I followed his ashen gaze to the figure that made its way into the room. He was a tall man, lean yet muscular, after the fashion of a professional duelist, or a professional assassin. The man wore a suit of brigantine armor about his body, a breastplate of Gromril, that fabulous metal of the dwarves, over his chest. Belts of knives, crossbow bolts, and other weapons encircled his waist and crossed his chest above the armor. A heavy falchion sword swung from his hip. The man's face was partially obscured, the region above his upper lip hidden behind the rounded surface of his black steel helm. As I gazed upon him, he turned, and for a moment the icy blue eyes that stared from behind the visor met my own. The man at my side muttered a word under his breath.
"Brunner!"
Farini croaked. He cast a desperate look at the two brutish men who had been with him before my arrival. The pair of bandits was already in motion, one pulling a long-bladed dagger from his belt, the other hefting a heavy club of steel and oak. As the man Farini had identified as Brunner began to walk towards our table, Farini's comrades assaulted him. There was a flash of light as a knife whipped from one of the armored man's gloved hands, and I saw the club-wielder drop his weapon as the blade sank into his forearm. Even as he screamed, Brunner turned on him, kicking in his teeth with a steel-toed boot. The other bandit charged the killer from behind. Brunner dodged the stabbing blade. I did not see what happened next, however, though I could hear the man screaming a moment later. For I was hurrying out of the side door of the Maid of Albion, hastening after my drinking partner, who had risen from the table and scurried away the instant Brunner's attention had been diverted to the other bandits. Had I been even a moment tardier in my pursuit, I should have never caught up with the weasel-faced bandit. The door opened upon a narrow alley, and my former companion was already half the way down its length. It took a tremendous effort to catch him. When I did, he spun on me, a dagger clenched in one fist. He recognized me in an instant and withdrew the blade, then turned to run. I placed a hand on his shoulder and told him I knew of a place where he could hide. He sighed a moan of thanks through heavy breaths, and the two of us slid down a dank alleyway toward a dingy little hostel where I kept my rooms. Farini immediately went to the single window that looked down upon the street, quickly searching for any sign of pursuit. Finding none, he hastily slammed the shutters, sealing off the window. Then, feeling a bit safer, some of the old bravado wormed its way back into the bandit, and he began to tell me about this figure of dread, this walking herald of death and judgment. Brunner was a bounty hunter, Farini explained. The man's name was a fearful whisper among bandits, pirates and highwaymen as far away as the forests of Bretonia and the villages of the Reichland. It was said that once Brunner had set out to catch a man, that man's days were numbered, not in years, but in weeks. It was said that the bounty hunter had spirited a buccaneer captain from the sanctuary of the pirate stronghold of Sartosa, that he had brought down a traitor to the king of Bretonia in the court of an Arabian sheik, and that he had pursued one notorious smuggler to the depths of the Black Crag, and returned with his prey from the bowels of the goblin fortress, or at least the man's head. With sword and bow, there were few men who could match him, and none who could claim supremacy over him in both. The tales went on, each more terrible and grim than the last. Then Farini's face went white once more. I turned to see what had horrified the bandit so. Standing in the doorway was the armored figure of the bounty hunter. So silently he had come, I never heard even the softest footfall, the merest creak of the door. It was as if some demon prince had snapped his fingers and summoned a man from thin air. Farini fumbled for his sword. I heard a rasp of steel as the bounty hunter drew his own. Farini shrieked and threw down his weapon, scrambling for the window and throwing open the shutters. The bounty hunter was upon him in an instant. Farini became a dead weight in Brunner's gloved hands, sobbing like a child. A liquid stench rose from the bandit's trousers. The bounty hunter did not hold onto his prey, but hurled him screaming through the window. There was a dull thud as the man landed on the cobblestones 3 floors below. The bounty hunter leaned from the window as screams of pain rose from the street.
"Just his leg," I heard a voice as cold and chill as an open grave grumble. "Thought he'd break his neck. Guess I'll just have to drag him back up here and try again."
The armored figure turned from the window and began to stalk towards the door with long, pantherish steps. Brunner exuded an aura of menace, a tangible feeling of impending violence, a promise of death. But there was something about him that at once captivated and fascinated me. I thought of the sparrow who sees a serpent, knows it for what it is, yet cannot tear its eyes away and fly from its company. I was also reminded of an old saying, a favorite of my father's: the great and the good are not always one and the same. I at once decided that I must speak with this man. The idea had sprung into my mind that the exploits of such a man would be no boastful lies told by some loutish ruffian seeking to enlarge a drunken ego. No, whatever words might pass between myself and a man like this, they would be the truth. A dark, brutal, murderous truth, but truth is not always a pleasant thing. And Ernesto was not paying me to pen parables for the cult of Shalia. I must confess that my voice was like the squeak of a mouse when I addressed the bounty hunter for the first time. The man's face, clothed as ever in the steel mask of his helm, fixed upon me, as if becoming aware of my presence for the first time. The breath caught in my throat, and for a moment I was certain that I had foolishly invited Moore to reach up from the shadows and pull me into the kingdom of the dead. But, after a second, the bounty hunter relaxed his grip on the hilt of his sword. The icy voice spoke again, demanding to know what I wanted. I stumbled over my words several times as I tried to relate the idea. It seemed no less suicidal than walking up to a sleeping dragon, knocking it upon the head, and loudly proclaiming its mother to be the lowest form of lizard. The bounty hunter listened for a moment, and I watched as a curious light crept into his eyes, as if the blue glaciers behind the visor of his steel face were melting. There was silence. I finally said that I could pay him, and preferred the leather purse that contained money I had earned from a month of prying stories from the addled memories of pirates and thieves deep in their cups. A gloved hand closed about the bag and stuffed it into his belt. I later came to understand how unusual a gesture this was, for Brunner did not count what I had given him. Whatever moved him to speak with me that night, in my dingy little room, the money was nothing more than a dressing. The bounty hunter walked back into the room, closed a hand about the back of a single wooden chair that was part of my furnishings, and set it beside the window, in order that he might keep an eye on the moaning man in the street below. I hastened to my table, digging quill, ink, and parchment from their cubbyholes, and set myself upon the floor, eager to begin recording the bounty hunter's adventures, before he thought better of such a charitable impulse. He waited until I was ready, and then the icy voice began to speak.